We are in New York now, and we have the good fortune of interviewing Father Malachi Martin. And perhaps we could begin by your telling us a bit about yourself, your background, and some of the activities that you are currently engaged in.
Well, Bernard, I think I'm going to bore you, but perhaps somebody listening to this tape doesn't know much about me, so I suppose we should cover the essentials. I was born in Ireland, in Kerry, 70 years ago. And 70 years ago, don't forget the 70, 70. And then I was educated in Ireland, and I joined the Jesuits in Ireland just before the war began. And then after the war, having done my philosophy, studies of philosophy for 3 years, and taught little children for another 3, they sent me to Belgium for my studies. And I remained there until 1958. And then I had been down to Rome in between years, and when I was finished in Louvain, they posted me to Rome to the Biblical Institute, the Pontifical Biblical Institute. That's an institute in the Vatican which trains professors of Scripture. It's fallen on evil days as regards doctrine, they tell me, and I think so. But in those days, it was pretty good. And then the Vatican Council started, and I had gone to my superiors in 1957 and said, look, I don't think I'm in the right place in life. I think God wants me elsewhere. But there was a lot of work to be done. And then I got into harness with a cardinal in Rome, Cardinal Augustin Beer, a German cardinal, who was a great friend of the Pope's. And I decided that I'd work on with him, and besides teaching at the Biblical Institute. And I wrote books and published articles on my field, which is paleography, which means ancient handwriting. I specialized in handwriting at the time of Abraham, which is about 1700 BC. And then in 1964, then, with the permission of the then Pope, Paul VI, I left, and I came over to America in 1965, and I've remained here ever since. I lived in New York for the simple reason that the first city I came to, the boat landed here, the U.S., the United States steamship, which I always joke was not a boat at all. It was an eating house with sleeping rooms attached, run by a crowd of landlubbers, but it was a pleasant ship to travel on. And I remained here ever since, and I've been engaged in doing TV and radio and writing books. I say Mass every morning. I'm a priest, and say my breviary, and try to keep the Decalogue and do the usual things. And that's about the sum total of it all. I published 15 books. I'm preparing a 16th, and there are a lot of articles. You know, the usual run of articles one has to publish in The Remnant and elsewhere. That's about my life story. It's very uneventful, but it's my life. I have a family still living in Ireland, brothers and sisters, and there are certain parts of Ireland, if you go there and throw a stone in any direction, you're going to hit a friend of a relative of mine, a blood relative of mine. We're a very numerous clan in southwest Kerry.
And so now then we'll proceed with the interviews, and we're going to be discussing the topic of Satan and his influence in the world today, and also in the church. But before we launch into that, I think perhaps you should give our listeners some background or some refresher on just who Satan is and what the origin is of the struggle between good and evil in the world.
Yes, Bernard, I feel a little more competent than usual to talk about this, because from about my third year in New York, I got engaged in exorcism. And that was by sheer accident. One night I was rung up by a priest who was in the middle of an exorcism, and his assistant collapsed. So he asked me to put on my clothes and come. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and come over to the Bronx and help him out, which I did. And then that started an association. So I've been in that field for quite a while, and I got very interested then in the subject of Satanism and as they call him in America, Old Scrat himself, because we always call him that in America. And so I feel a little competent talking about it. The amazing thing about our friend, or our enemy, as he really is that most people are in possession of half lies about him and half truth. There's very little truth known about the devil. We do know from the church and from Scripture that Satan was an archangel, that he was one of the brightest and most intelligent of the archangels. We do know that he influenced, at the dawn of creation, before man was created, he did influence a whole horde of other angels, telling them that they would be like unto God, that they would have his power. But there's the half-lie. The half-lie of that consists of this. Satan never knew God. He never saw God. If he had seen God, he could never have fallen. He'd be an angel in heaven. So he never knew God, no more than Adam saw God. Adam knew, worked, talked to God and walked with him, as the scripture says, through a medium of some kind or other. But he didn't see God. Therefore, the devil knows far less about God than we think. In fact, you know, several of the fathers of the church have speculated that hell consists of a huge doubt in Satan's mind. Is he really there? What's he like? Is he really eternal? Will he end too? Is there a problem? He doesn't know, because he's being tortured by doubt for the rest of his existence. And you know, if you study the notes left behind by suicides and examine their history, the worst form of suicide is the one who doubts. He doesn't know at all. He's doubtful about his own self, he's doubtful about humanity, doubtful about the other side. It's diabolic. And this is the curse of Satan. He will never know. Number one. Now, he did, though, rebel. And apparently there was, as the scripture puts it, a great battle between the good angels, led by Michael the archangel, against Lucifer, the light bearer. Apparently he was called the son of the dawn. He was so brightly intelligent. Probably more intelligent than Michael, but not as faithful. And you know, fidelity and faithfulness often win out over intelligence, as we've seen in our own history. So he was defeated. And Jesus, who normally was very, very descriptive and gentle-minded, he had to make reference once to Satan, Satan's fall, to Lucifer's fall from heaven when he was defeated. And he said, you've seen the lightning go from the east to the west in one zigzag flash. It takes less than a hundredth of a second. Well, he said, he fell faster than that. And the utter, not cruelty, but harshness. I mean, there was no streak of mercy. There was no, he made no bones about it. This angel was punished with supreme punishment. He was condemned to what we call hell. And hell, we do know about hell, one thing for sure, which you must hold if you're going to be a faithful Catholic, that there's fire there. Now, fire can be of various kinds, and fire in scripture can be also spiritual, but that he is tortured there forever with his angels, yes. But God, in view of the world he was going to create, gave Satan a certain series of powers. And those powers are that he would test man. Christians have always wondered, and the church has always speculated about why God did this, because why should God give him a leg at all? As far as we know, God does love purity. He does love mercy. He does love compassion. He loves beauty. Look at the beautiful things he's created in nature, the animals and the babies and flowers and trees, lakes, mountains, oceans, sky. All the beauties we see around us, ourselves, our own beings. Look at me. My body has been going for 70 years. Only God could create it. It has its own particular beauty in that sense. It's not very beautiful, as you see, and not like a wrinkled nut, but the machine is still going. Now, but God preferring all those things, he has one great preference, repentance. He loves to exercise mercy. We have to take this as a given, Bernard. This is a King of God. So how could he do that unless people were tempted and he had to forgive them? He didn't want a perfect world. He wanted to have a world in which he could exercise mercy. And you know, there's this marvelous psalm which has about 127 times, for his mercy is above all his works. And this is what Jesus wanted. And that's why it's so mistaken of people who sin, as we all do, because they're caught by something, either the concupiscence of the flesh or the concupiscence of the eyes or the pride of life or whatever. And they feel they've gone so far that they can't get back. That's the very situation that God envisaged. He wants you to come. He wants to forgive. Until you die, there's that marvelous possibility of being received like the prodigal son. Anyway, so he gave Satan the power of tempting man. Just a word about that. We must remember this angel has extremely limited intelligence. He doesn't know what you know by faith, for instance. He doesn't know it. He doesn't know anything about the angelic life. He doesn't know about the Blessed Sacrament. He knows it's the nameless one, as Satan is called, the Blessed Sacrament. He doesn't know the future. He can't predict the future, except I, for instance, can predict the future. If I look at the clouds and say, yeah, the rain clouds are going to come. He has a greater perception of natural things because he's an angel. He can predict in that sense. But he doesn't know what's going to happen in 1996 or 2004. He's extremely limited. But he is the cleverest liar going, because he deals with half-truths. Half-truth. And most of the information you find people trotting out about Lucifer today is the half-lie. He's broadcast about himself. And that's so pernicious, because that ruins our possibility of knowing him. Now, Lucifer, we know too, from the Church, was given a certain amount of liberty in the beginning until Christ came. And once Christ died on the cross, he was bound in chains. And the Church was given 1,000 years, it was said, in which to flourish. We got that 1,000 years. And according to all of the fathers, what they teach, and the revelations which the Church has declared as authentic, that 1,000 years expired about the 1700s or 1800s. And we now are in a moment when Satan was loosed, and again the voice of revelation and the voice of tradition and the voice of the teachers and the Church and the saints and the popes comes in and say, but his loosing was only for 100 years, and that freedom of his is coming to an end in our day, in the 1990s. So we have been subject, therefore, to Lucifer's raging freedom to recoup what we lost. Because remember, in that 1,000 years between, say, the year 400 and the year 1400, Christianity spread. Whole peoples were converted. Whole of Europe was. And when they got to Mexico, they converted 8 million in 2 years. Remember, it was astounding. And Christianity did spread. And even today, Christianity is the biggest religion going. And the Catholic Church is 18% of the human race. It's almost 1 billion. So he lost an awful lot. A point about that, Bernard, which we must always remark on, is this. It is dogmatic that not everybody will be saved. There is a destined group whom God has foreseen will cooperate with him and will be saved. But it's not a majority of people, and it's not all the people, which is an error people are pushing nowadays. In other words, so the 1,000 years probably raked in those souls that were to be saved and would cooperate, and the remnant then has struggled since the 1700s until today. And I think that if one looks, and we may in these talks, in these tapes, we may touch on the evidence we now have that Satan is having his last stand. This is his Waterloo, but he's going to kill off, destroy much, scorched earth policy, destroy as much as he can before he finally is shoved down into the abyss again, chained by Michael. And then the reign of Our Lady and the Sacred Heart of Jesus will take place. I'm putting a lot of doctrine and revelation and conclusion into that, but that's the position of Satan. There's one more thing about Lucifer which we should remember, and it's this. We have no protection against him of ourselves. No one can match him on this earth. No one. He can deceive anybody. St. Paul says that he is the transforms himself into an angel of light. And therefore, no matter how lofty you think your motive is, no matter how correct you think your doctrine is, you need protection. And that protection comes to a Catholic, a Christian, a Catholic, especially in two ways. It comes from the voice of the Church, when the Church speaks clear, with a clear voice. Sometimes I wish our churchmen spoke with a clearer voice, but anyway, the Church speaks, and the magisterium, as we call it, which nowadays has been rather mute in the voices of its appointed speakers. And number two, you have the protection of Michael and the angels. That's their function. And remember this, that the reason, to go back to Lucifer's beginnings, we know from the fathers that the crisis between him and God consisted about Christ, concerned Christ. Apparently, to use human language, Lucifer and his angels were shown Jesus Christ as a baby and as a man wandering around Palestine, barefoot, a scrawny Palestinian with a beard and a robe on him, with not a penny, very few pennies in the purse. And he was asked to adore him. And he was shown a vision of this man crucified, which is the same as being hanged. And he was told to adore this thing of clay. And to ask Lucifer to do that? No. He wanted to be up on the mountain of the Most High in the congregation of the North, to be equal to God. He wasn't going to do that.
So it was the sin of pride.
Of course, sin of pride. Sin of pride. He was going to be it. Now, the reason that God did that was that he gave the option to all the angels. This is going to be the situation. You will service this man and his followers. You will protect them. You will, part of you will be up beside my throne, praying for them and making their prayers ascend to my heart. The other part of you will be steward angels. You will guide their feet. You will guard their houses. You'll protect them from wild animals. You'll cure them when they're ill. You'll stave them off when they're feeling guilty, when they're cruel. You'll remind them that they're children of God and they're supposed to be faithful to my laws. Will you do this? Option. Freedom. Or completely autonomous. Lucifer and his people said, no, we're angels. That thing of a lump of clay born in a bed between the legs of a woman and finally expiring and being eaten by worms, and we are immortal and you want us to... So he refused. So it is the sin of pride. And that's why the one great God is to call on the angels, because we don't use them at all. And the funny thing about the angels and Lucifer is this. The funny thing about the angels is that if you don't call on them, they don't be very active. If you call on them and expect about 40% from them, they'll give you 40%. If you call on them and expect 90%, they'll give you 90%. If you call on them and expect 100%, not hoping, you know, hope, as somebody said, is a very good companion but a bad guide. You must believe you're going to get 100%. If you do, you'll get 100%. It's a funny way God has of treating us. The same is true for Our Lady too. At La Salette, when she was speaking to the two children, they said, how can we believe you, Lady, Madame? And she said, if you believe in me, I'll believe in you. There's a quid pro quo with God, because he consented to treat us like that. So with Satan, with Lucifer, as I prefer to call him, those are the only two protections we have against him, because St. Peter says he's like a lion going around seeking whom he may devour. And he is intent on eviscerating the church, on corrupting your soul and my soul, destroying priesthood, removing the tabernacle, destroying all chastity and purity, completely destroying the family, and producing a world in which there is no church, there is no compassion, there is no pity, there is no love, there is no gentleness, and there is only death and pain and destruction. You know, I work with Satanists who are reformed, and they all tell me the three tests they have to go through in order to become a Satanist, an official Satanist. And we'll touch on their existence, by the way, in a later conversation here today. But they have to kill, show they're indifferent to death. Usually they have a puppy dog or a cat or a kitten or something, or a bird. And they have to burn to show a love for fire. And thirdly, they have to be cruel. Not kill, but just cruel. Cause a dog or a cat or a bird or a human being to scream at pain but not kill them, and love to do it. That's the world of Lucifer. And by the way, if you look around at what we consider the blots in our landscape, whether it's Los Angeles or San Francisco or New York or cities in Canada, wherever it is, or Paris or London, what we call the seamy side, the inhuman side, is always filled with what? Death, arson, cruelty to children, to women, to men. So Satan's thumb mark is everywhere. The cloven hoof.
And what are devils?
Devils are those angels who went with Lucifer. They see, you could ask me, and many people have, how many are there? Bernard, in this room, how many people are there sitting?
Two.
That's right. And how do you know that? You count. One body, two bodies, second body. Now, an angel hasn't got a body. You can't count them numerically. That's the difficulty. In that world of the spirit, there is no numerical separation because they are spirits and they haven't got a body, and they're spirits that cannot die. So in our language, there are zillions, there are millions of them. Christ said at the drop of a hat in Gethsemane standing when Peter drew his sword, he said, put up your sword. If I ask my Father for one moment, he'll send a legion. And a legion in his mouth meant hundreds of thousands of angels immediately to defend him. They're there because they don't take up any space. This old thing about how many angels stand on the head of a pin is an old Protestant reproach for Catholic philosophers. The head of a pin they don't stand on anything. They're immaterial, but they're real. They're real. Everybody has one. Everybody has a guardian angel. And we are told by some of the fathers, everybody has a devil assigned to them, depending on their character. If I'm a sensuous character, I have one who wants to tempt me sensually and sexually. If I'm greedy and avaricious, it'll be for money and all the other various things. But we know from exorcism, by the way, that the devils specialize. And they're very stupid outside that when you get talking to them. They're extremely stupid. but in their métier, in their actual profession, what they're experiencing, whether intellectual or they're scientific or mathematical or what, they're very, very clever. They've got their material pat down pat. So they're formidable things to come up against, and they're very active.
Now, why do modern theologians scoff at the very idea of the devil and guardian angels and the whole concept sometimes even of evil?
I'll tell you why they do. But it's a short answer, and don't be dissatisfied with it until you hear the explanation of it. Simply, they belong to the apostasy. It's as short as that. What does that mean? It means they have lost their faith. If you deny the devils, if you deny the existence of Lucifer, if you deny the existence of sin, of hell, of eternal punishment, you automatically deny Christ's salvation. You automatically deny God's goodness. And the whole purpose of the cross, the whole incarnation is destroyed. In fact, you can't deny the existence of Lucifer without being led inevitably to deny the divinity and the function of Christ as Savior. What's the purpose in Christ's coming? What is the purpose? To make a nice land, to give us more eggs, more happy lives on earth? No, no, he came to save us from sin, S-I-N. So that's the reason. Now, the reason I say it's the apostasy is this, that there is evidence, and I cannot get over the evidence, and I'm one of millions, that we are today in the grip of the beginning of a major apostasy. That is, overnight, as it were, Bernard, in a church which 30 years ago was peopled with solid lines and ranks of clergymen and nuns and priests and lay people, all believers, nobody ever questioning the fundamentals or even the accidentals. Overnight, we suddenly turn around. We have cardinals who don't believe, and we know they don't. We have bishops that don't believe, and we know they don't. We have priests that don't believe, and we know it. We have nuns that don't believe. We have whole segments of the population that have stopped going to Mass, stopped going to confession. They don't believe any longer, because there's a rule in belief, which is absolutely categoric. And I, by an example, let me tell you what it is. If I say I love you, but I never look at you. I never buy you any roses. I never buy you a meal. I don't see you at night or in the morning. I don't say good morning, good evening. The next time I tell you I love you, you can say, well, big joke. what does love mean? I believe in God. Well, if you believe in God, then why are you violating his rules? And why do you deny the dogmas of his church, which you know is his true church and is infallible? So they have lost their faith. They're apostatic. They're apostates. The difficulty is this, with disbelief. This, I make a comment about certain cardinals in the United States, certainly some archbishops in Canada where you live, and many, many priests and many bishops throughout the United States. When you lose your faith, do you know you've lost it, Bernard?
You don't.
You couldn't, because otherwise you get it back. They don't know. They think you're stupid because you have retained these so-called superstitions and myths. They don't know. And that's the curse of disbelief. Once he withdraws the gift, hey, fella, you can't believe any longer. You are incapable of it. And only his mercy can grasp you by the nape of the neck and lift you out of that morass. And he doesn't always do it. And remember, too, that I think we should all remember that it's very easy to lose your faith, far easier at least than you think. I need never doubt a dogma. I need never attack some rule of the church. I need never criticize the Bible and yet lose my faith because I'm unfaithful to my vow of marriage if I'm married, my vow of celibacy if I'm a priest, my vow, my obligation not to steal if I really am a thief or robber, my obligation not to kill another human being, not to murder them. If I violate any of those things, faith is immediately chipped away. And the moment, and the more I deepen into that, faith disappears. So I can leave my faith and say, no, I want to believe all those things, but I can't any longer. And the last thing to notice about faith is it's not an emotion. It's knowledge, Bernard. What happens in faith is the will, the mind proposes a proposition. God exists. God is my creator. Jesus, save me. There is a hell. The Pope is infallible. The church is the church of God, outside of which there's no salvation. And my will freely locks my mind into it and says, take it. Accept it blindly, without proof. That's faith. But it's knowledge. And St. Paul says it's knowledge through a glass darkly. But that means that when I do believe, when I receive Christ in the Blessed Eucharist, when I say the rosary, when I make the stations of the cross, when I go to Mass, when I fulfill my obligations and my state of life, I I'm in contact spiritually and supernaturally with God, and I know him, but I don't know what I know, unless sometimes by intuition he gives me a knowledge of it, or unless I come to the hour of death and then I suddenly see all I know and all I don't know. So it's a knowledge, and we mustn't forget that. Satan wants to corrupt that knowledge. And what he does is he tries to distract you. And we'll go in, if you wish, later on, or anytime you like, we will go into his methods of getting at your faith, how does he undermine it.
Let's do that right now.
Okay. The way he does it is as follows. Remember, there's a cardinal rule this idiot angel must observe, and it is that he can only touch your senses. He cannot touch your soul unless you've given it to him, unless you're possessed. And even then he has difficulties. It's a roundabout process for him. All he can do is enter your soul through the normal means. What is the normal means? It's this. You have five senses, your whole body. Okay? And then you have inside you a thing called imagination. It's a faculty. And that faculty has pictures. And you have a memory which recalls those pictures. Okay? Now, we get our normal pictures. You're sitting in this room, and if you look over to that wall there, you see a mirror. A beveled mirror. And if you look over there, there are blue books and brown books and yellow books and photographs and busts, heads of people that live here. And there are icons hanging on the wall and there are candlesticks. All those images have already gone into your imagination, are stored away there. And with a good memory, you can pick them all out and recall them all. That's the way you get images. And because you have a mind that thinks and you have me talking at you, you'll understand what these icons mean, what those books tell, and what those candlesticks are used for, and who are these people whose busts are up on the shelf there. So it's through images, though. Now, if he can implant images on your imagination, they're transmitted to your mind and soul. That's the only way they go. So he will plant firm images on me unless I'm careful. That's why one must watch one's imagination and one's eyes. Because if you go out in the street out there, but at the present moment, and see a mother eviscerating her baby, you will not take your eyes off it. And it will be a memory you will never lose. If you turn on the boob tube, as we call it in the States, the television, and you see some obscene action between two people, male, female, male, male, female, female, whatever, the garbage we see nowadays, the pornography, you see that, and you follow all the details, it is in you. You have the image, and that is a ready tool for him to suggest to you various things that you could do. Or if you look at money in a certain way, piles of dollars or whatever it is, or gold, or somebody's very valuable necklace, and you lust after it, the image goes into you. He has a means, therefore, of working on you. And that's all he needs is one toe hold, and he has you by the neck, the scruff of the neck. So that's why It's always laughed at nowadays by the very, very advanced avant-garde in these matters. But what they used to call custody of the eyes and custody of the hands. And there is no man alive who can lay immodest hands on a woman without being tempted. He's not made of flesh. Psychologically, he has to be. And vice versa. So you've got to watch how you touch and what you look at and what you listen to. Because the voice can be a terrible medium of persuasion, as you and I know. And those are the means by which Satan enters. Now, it doesn't mean that you've got to go around like a barbed wire camp, watching everything, refusing to look at things, refusing to talk. No. We can develop in a child and in a man, in a woman, you can develop the habits of self-control so that they feel the impact of something, but they easily get out of it. They're not fascinated by it. The difficulty about the television is that that's all it is, a terminal image that attracts you and fills you. There's nothing beyond it, there's no depth. That's how Satan works. He works on individuals in that way, but he's a geopolitician, and he has plans for the entire world. And his plans, at that level, go to the bureaucracies, go to the boardrooms, go to the CEO's office, go to the government, parliament, and the civil and federal and state governments. And there they influence individuals as a group. And we have examples of that in the United States and in Canada too. In the United States we have that as regards the approval of homosexuality, homosexual marriages, the approval of pornography as an example of art, if you please, and all the other things. That it's by groups he works. And once you get a group of people together in a phalanx, peer pressure makes them all move in the same direction, but behind it all, there's that grinning face of the old goat who's got what he wanted through his surrogates. That's how he works.
It's interesting that you mentioned the point that he works through reaching the senses, because I was in a bookstore once, and I picked up a Satanist Bible, and it said that the key principle of Satanism was that of indulgence, whereas a key principle of Christianity is that of sacrifice.
That's right. That's right. You see, the two words that are whispered in the ear of everybody's soul, so to speak, by the tempter is, why not? Why not have it? Especially if it's what they call a victimless action. Nobody's hurt by it. You just enjoy yourself. You get your gold, you get your woman, you get your man, you get your boy, you get your food, you get whatever you want illegally. Why not? And it is self-indulgence. And for that phrase, why not, embodies exactly the principle that he uses. And he trains us to use with ourselves. Why not have it? You're doing no harm to nobody. It's victimless. And you have a right to it. And it belongs to John Smith or Mabel Kelly. But after all, you're just as good as them. And they won't know anyway. And it won't hurt them. And they have no right to it. They're too stupid. So why not have it, my friend? It's self-indulgence. And it's the hardest thing in the world, Bernard, I find, in the pastoral work I do, to tell good, solid citizens, no, you have to make a sacrifice. And they'll say, well, why? I haven't committed a sin. It's not so much that. It is that if you do curb your self-indulgence, even legitimate self-indulgence, because you're not supposed to touch illegitimate self-indulgence, but if you do curb legitimate self-indulgence, like that extra chocolate eclair, self-indulgence of various kinds. Once we start on that road, and I find it very hard to inculcate to a lot of good people that, you know, you make voluntary sacrifices to train yourself, because this is a warfare. And asceticism, as you know, means exercise. The original Greek word means to exercise oneself in the as a gladiator, as a fighter in the amphitheater, at the games. You have to be active and curbing things just to be able to say, I can say no. That's why a total addiction to smoking or to drinking, apart from the alcohol part of it, drinking, or to chocolate or to anything, a total addiction, there's something wrong in it, there's something unchristian, there's something sinful, at least venially sinful. You are self-indulgent and you can't do that. Nature will come against you and finally your soul will suffer from it.
Let's move on now to the topic of exorcism and possession. And you wrote a book called Hostage to the Devil, actually a number of years ago.
That's right. We'll bring out another edition of that, because although we still have a lot of copies to sell of the old edition and the paperback edition, we decided that we need a new preface, because things have gone... When I wrote that book in 1975, I wrote it for one reason, one reason only, Bernard. I wrote it because I found that my contemporaries in America and in Canada and Australia and Ireland had forgotten what it was all about. They didn't know what exorcism was. And there was a very funny picture called The Exorcist based on the book by William Blatty, which is totally erroneous as regards exorcism. It's a phony exorcism, because it makes out exorcism to be a sort of a combination of Frankenstein and Dracula, with a lot of green goo and windows breaking and bodies flying. It's much more terrible and lethal than that. So I decided, since I was in exorcisms and doing a lot of work, that I would get, with permission, the transcripts of 5 to 10 exorcisms and publish them as such with a preface. I found, of course, I could only publish 5 of them because they were lengthy. Some of these exorcisms were 400 hours. Some of them were 5 days. Some of them were long. The normal exorcism takes, and nowadays anyway, the major exorcism takes anything up to 3 or 4 weeks. And we always take photographs, videos, and we take radio, and we take a tape recording of the whole thing. So I decided to publish that, and having published it then, in the northeast corner of America where I work in this field, we had about 40 major exorcisms per year, but thousands of minor exorcisms. Because exorcism is divided into 2 parts. First of all, let's talk about a little bit about possession. What happens is that somebody gives their soul to Lucifer, in this sense that they consent to be his worshipper and servitor. It sounds as if nobody would do it, but thousands do it, and we can explain the process by which that's done. Anyway, the point comes to the point of possession. And possession means that you no longer possess your own will. It's the will only. There is a myth that the devil enters into your body. The devil can't enter your body because he hasn't got a body to enter your body with. You understand me? He's not a physical shape. But do you remember Hitler, that bold, bad man Hitler? He possessed the wills and the minds of millions of Germans. He never entered their bodies. He caught their will. See, if I can control your mind and your will, I possess you. And the greater the extent of my possession, the greater is my hold over you. And you can see that. And when we had that awful man, I think his name was Steinberg, with Lisa, his common law wife, and he made her be cruel to this little child who died finally. In this, we had this awful case 2 years ago in New York. It's a case of some man dominating a woman. Sometimes it's woman dominating a man. So dominating that they are their servants, their slaves. That's the nature of possession. Except that once the spirit has been allowed to get power in you, it is very hard to break it. You can't break away. You must do it voluntarily, by the way. There's no such thing as involuntary possession. You don't wake up one morning and say, my goodness, the devil has possessed me. That doesn't happen. You have asked him in. And he finally arrives, bag and baggage, scrip and scrippage, to stay forever. Now, that's possession. People often confuse it with what we call obsession. Obsession is where he's softening you up, if I can use that expression, but a horrible process, where you're being harassed. And it's very much like this. Supposing I start harassing you, Bernard, and I say, if you don't give me $2,000, and I know you have it in your pocket, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to injure your wife. I'm going to damage your children. I'm going to ruin your reputation. And I keep harassing you. And you get letters about this and telephone calls, and I meet you suddenly in the street, I meet your wife and say, does your husband know how dangerous, what dangerous position he's put you into? I get the children at the playground and I say, your daddy's a very bad man. He's going to have you killed. I harass him. I harass you. And all it does is persuade you finally to do my will. And the will is, let me in, please. Let me possess you. Give me your will. That's obsession. Many people get into terrible conditions of melancholia, have to go to a shrink or a doctor. It never strikes them that what they are is they're being harassed by Satan. Sometimes it happens a man who is not very happy in his marriage, but he's fixed, he doesn't want to leave his wife, and he's harassed about another woman who is available. He's harassed and says, listen, if you don't take this woman and have an affair with her, sleep with her, have her as your mistress, you're going to break up physically. Your nerves need this. So it's harassed from that point of view. So the harassment, we say harassment in America, but I was trained in England and Ireland, so I say harassment. I hope people understand the word. Harassment is another thing completely. That's obsession. You're besieged. Now, possession is, once it sets in, is something from which you cannot extricate yourself. The only person that can extricate you is Christ. Christ normally doesn't do it directly. He delegates that to his apostles, and those are the bishops in the church. And the bishops must therefore authorize every exorcism. Unfortunately, nowadays, most of the bishops I know don't believe in the devil. Or if they believe in vague sort of principle of evil or something, they certainly don't believe in possession. They think you should go to a shrink. And they do send ordinary faithful to come, and I've stopped sending them to certain bishops now, they send them off to see a local shrink and go to a home, rest up, get drugs. And it only makes it worse. And it's a terrible plight. But that's due to the lack of faith in bishops and priests. Then even when the bishop does believe, the parish priest doesn't, and he laughs them out of the confessional. And Bernard, I could spend my whole life just talking to people about their possession and obsession and advising them what to do. It's one of the biggest needs today. We can expand on the why it's necessary today. When I started in 1975 in this field, there were about 40 to 50, 50, 60, perhaps, major exorcisms per day, per year, and then thousands of small ones. Now, there has been an increase of over 750% since 1975. And that is terrible. That is terrible. There's no sign of this diminishing. And unfortunately, Satanism and possession have taken a very ugly turn. They've become Satanist pedophilia. Let me explain that. In other words, the Satanist, and in this country alone, in America, you know, in the USA, there are about, we know of 8,773 covens, that is, satanic groups, professionally devoted to worshipping Satan. And remember, that means victims, and it means black masses, and it means gross irreverence and sacrilege of the Blessed Host and the precious blood every day. It means all that. So Satanism is spread very far and wide, but it has now attained a height or depth of iniquity that rarely exceeded before. It is this: the normal Satanist group looks for a child, preferably a little boy, to be the victim. And unspeakable horrors are committed on that poor victim. They love that. That is the supreme sacrifice. Because remember, Satan set out to destroy a child once, and he was foiled. And that child, Jesus, grew up to be a man and destroyed Satan's empire and sent him scurrying back to hell. And he is the enemy. So he wants to take it out on as many children as he can. Hence his delight in abortion. And there are about 400 million abortions per year throughout the world that we know of, probably many more than that. But 400 million babies are sacrificed by a knife or by cruelty, by some form of murderous cruelty, just to satisfy Satan's whim. And that's the terrible thing about mothers who wake up to the fact that they committed this sin. The trauma is so deep, sometimes you can do nothing for them at all, except pray. But Satan is being paid that tribute per year in this world. That's probably why one reason why we all know there's a chastisement coming. Nothing but chastisement could clean this out. We've gone so far down the road.
Now, you mentioned that in these covens, they hold black masses.
Sure.
What are black masses?
In the entire practice of genuine Satanism, the principle is to do everything backwards. The crucifix is always there, a crucifix hung upside down. A black mass consists of taking the Roman mass, not the Novus Ordo, because they don't believe that's a real mass. They take the Roman mass and they say it backwards. They start at the last gospel and they work their way back to the beginning, except the words of consecration and the consecration itself, which is always said, if it's a genuine black mass, by a priest, an apostate priest. So it's definitely, there's a consecration of bread and wine, and they're violated. But before you go to start a satanic mass, they make you go to confession. And in confession, what do? You confess the sins you didn't commit. Because that's what you have offended Satan in. You haven't helped him along at all. You didn't commit that adultery. You didn't steal that money. You didn't kill that boy. You didn't, whatever. You didn't tell that lie you could have told. Whatever sin you could have committed, you didn't. You confess that sin. The worshippers are always naked, and they have an altar. It's a regular mass. And on the altar, they always have the naked body of the victim, whoever he or she is. And the details are too noisome and repugnant for most people to know. And even you come across somebody who's been through it, they have this blank look at the back of their eyes, burners. You know, will never fade out. You know, they'll always have this. Even though they repent. But even in normal life, there's a part of their soul which has been withered, like your arm being withered. Nothing can be done about it. Nothing. Because the blasphemy and sacrilege of a mass, of a black mass, is so deep that once you go through that, and I've never been at one, of course, I would never go to one, but once you go through it and participate in it, then you've done something to your soul that only Christ can cure, and I don't know how many of them ever get out of it ever again. The last case we had was a woman, and she could tell us about it, but she couldn't get out of it. She had to go back. They held her with an iron grip. And no psychiatry, no psychology, no therapy could undo that. She couldn't be persuaded. She said, kill me and let me free. And she probably will commit suicide, and we can't stop it. And then Satan is served. Because as you know, suicide is the eighth sacrament. Lucifer. That's what it's called, the eighth sacrament.
Can we talk now a bit about exorcism?
Sure.
What is exorcism? Who does it? How is it done?
Well, the exorcism, first of all, must be done with the authority of a bishop who always gives it to a priest. There have been lay exorcists, by the way, in history. in times of want, bishops will take a very holy man and tell him to perform exorcism with permission. But normally it's a priest, because although many people do not realize it nowadays, once a priest's hands are consecrated, then there is a change in his soul, a spiritual change, which he will never lose again. And no matter how many priests say they're ex-priests and it's all over and it was a nice job and now they're doing something else, they will find out on the last day, if they haven't found out before they die, that their soul has been sealed away by God. And if they cover that soul with sin, that's their business. But it still belongs to God in a special way. Now, that soul of a priest, though, sinless, normally sinless and good, and saying Mass and doing his duty as a priest, is one thing Satan hates, because it's a reproduction of Christ. And the name that the devils in exorcism use for Christ, they never say Christ. They always say the nameless one, the great weakling, the milquetoast, always hurling insults at him, the carpenter from Nazareth. You can force them to say Christ, but then they're going to take it out on you. I did it once, and they punish you, and it's not a nice punishment at all. So you don't provoke them more than you need to. Now, so it must be a priest, and he must have authority from the bishop. I know bishops, and we've gone to them and said, look, John so-and-so or Mary so-and-so down the street in your diocese, they need exorcism, Your Honor, Your Excellency. And they've said, look, I know nothing about it, I want to know less, you have the authority, but never ask me again. They're afraid of it, they don't believe it, they're afraid not to believe it completely, they don't have anything to do with it. Anything to do with it. I know one bishop who's not like that, and he shall remain nameless, and he's regarded as an eccentric by his fellow bishops, because he believes in the devil, and believes in exorcism, and hasn't a full-time exorcist. In the Archdiocese of New York, there's no full-time exorcist. We get them from out of town. And that's not reflecting on the cardinal here. He does believe in the devil, we know, does believe in possession, that it does occur, does believe in exorcism too. But there are difficulties against this archdiocese appointing an exorcism that don't come from the cardinal, they come from the chancery. That means that some of his subordinates will have nothing to do with it. So we have to put up with that. In other dioceses, there is no exorcist, and the bishop doesn't believe in it, and the priest don't believe in it, and there's no help for you. And I could, if I were paid, say $20 for every exorcism I was asked to do in the last 30 years, or I could retire. I could have a fleet of assistants doing them on the side. The amount of people who know they're possessed and have deliberately walked into this trap and then can't do anything about it, because there's no priest, and there's no bishop willing to help them, and the bishop laughs them out of court. And the pathetic letters I get, which I can never publish, what the bishop said to them and told them to do, go away and have a good steak, a blood red steak, and have a good bottle of beer. If your wife, go and make love with her. If you haven't, well, take care of yourself, do something nice, which means go out to the local brothel or something like that. It's lack of faith. Again, we come back to the apostasy, because the first thing Satan wants to make sure is that you think he doesn't exist. It's the old principle. I remember when we were being instructed in intelligence in Rome and the Vatican, because we were doing some intelligence work, they tried to teach us anyway, some of them never picked it up, to be anonymous. So you could be in a crowd, nobody would notice you. The idea is you don't exist. We're here, but we don't exist. And that's why the great laugh Lucifer has at times is that he moves in jackboots in the boardrooms and bedrooms and in government offices and the parliament houses, and he doesn't exist. It's a myth, it's a joke. What a marvelous cover. What a marvelous cover. If Hitler or Stalin had spies of that caliber, they could have us in the bag long ago. He has us in the bag in this sense, because he has developed a sense of humor about old Nick, and we have a portrait about a black-looking man with big ears and yellow eyes and a forked tail and cloven hooves and dirty books under his arm behind a bush saying, psst, come here, I'll teach you how to sin. Satan is too urbane. He's too bland. He's too clever. He won't do that. It's too studied an approach. So that's exorcism for you, and who must do it? Exorcism itself is a ceremony which the church has a fixed form for exorcism. You find it in the normal prayer book. Nowadays, the prayer books don't have it precisely because the bishops dropped it in the prayer books. They were submitted them for their approval. But It's lengthy prayers, traditional prayers, calling on Saint Michael, and then there are other prayers that you put in, but a lot of it is left up to the exorcist, because at a certain moment I must turn around and say to you, the possessed person, who are you? And an exorcist never obeys, never answers a question. He asks a question. He never answers a question of the possessed person. Who are you? Why do you come here to... You can hear these people say this. Why do you come here to bother me? We've done nothing to you. Leave us alone, please. Martin, leave us alone, please. What do you want? Do you want women? Do you want money? Do you want food? Go away and have it. Leave us alone. What are you doing here? Never ask a question. Say, who are you? And you keep at it and you find their names. They all have a name. Ugly names. Sinister names. Sardonic names. Names that laugh at human beings. Names that make a joke of the loveliest things in the human body and the human mind. Always this awful, dirty touch things. And once you do that, you have them nailed. Because then they obey that name. They are answer that name. And then you proceed to find out who sent them, how do they come here, when, what's your speciality, what do you do? And it's like a dog trying to get away from you when you're after them. It's like a dog. And it'll bite your hand. It'll bite you mortally if you're not careful. And the failed exorcists are those who fell into the trap of answering questions. Because it's very interesting. And some of them are entrancing, humanly speaking. And they get tied up in it. And of course, before long, their will is going with the other, with the possessing demon's will. And they're stuck. And then other people are caught and badly injured because they do it without permission. And I know a very famous man in this country whom I helped to instruct in exorcism, with a warning. He was a layman and not a Catholic. Don't attempt it. Don't do it by yourself. He did, and he's possessed. Now, when you read about the normal possessed person that's brought to an exorcist to be exorcised, they're always violent. They smell sometimes, and they're cursing, and they're a social pain in the neck to everybody, and they're a liability to their family, and they burn themselves, and they hit their head against things, they scream, and then they're most unhygienic. They go to the bathroom any place, and they shock you with smells and all that sort of stuff. They're not doing that to hurt you. They are like the baby who's hungry, can't tell you, and is hitting his head against the ground. Do you ever see a baby do that? When they're with it's the way they have a signaling. They're trying to create pain to absorb pain in their tummies, which are empty, supposedly. But they're also signaling. When you see that, you know a baby saying, I'm hungry. Similarly, with a possessed person who's misbehaving themselves, as I've just described, in these 1001 awful, disgusting ways. Disgusting, burner, is the only word. The smell, the sight, the sound, the words, the actions. I mean, they dehumanize you. You never recover from it. Not really. It takes away a bit of yourself and leaves that with God until you get back to heaven and he reintegrates it. But they're saying, help me, I'm in trouble. They can't describe it. Some of them attempt to, and then they shut up, and then the devil takes over, the possessing spirit takes over, and they then proceed to act in another coy way. I remember once being asked to interview a woman who was a paraplegic in a wheelchair, and she spoke long about the wounds of Jesus and about Jerusalem and about the Pope and then proceeded to try and seduce me in a very subtle way. So it was only Satan using words that meant nothing at all, just using Christian words. Now, there is another form of possession which is terrible, and it's called perfect possession. I've only met a bare half dozen of perfectly possessed people. You see, when possession takes place, although you can't break from it, you know. And if grace of God comes to you, or if something happens that jogs your mind, with the grace of God finally, and you want to get out of it, you can finally get out of it. And if God sends you the grace, probably he's going to send you the means of being exorcised. But some people don't want to. Some people actually want to be possessed. They want to be holy Lucifers. I've met them, believe in me, it's as real as the nose on your face. And when they're perfectly possessed, they're completely urbane and calm and clean and efficient. They're good doctors, they're good lawyers, they're good architects, they're good bankers, they're good painters, they're good artists, they're good dancers. They're beautiful people, die schöne Leute, as the Germans used to say. But they're not schöne at all. They're not beautiful at all. But they're perfectly possessed. Except now and again, in an off moment, when they don't think you're looking at them, you see this face. You see this. I knew one very well in England. No, Ireland he was, I knew, but I met him in England later. And at first go over, it just seemed to be sort of a very metallic sort of a voice and a sort of a very sort of business-like way of talking. It wasn't much of the milk of human kindness, but I've known so many people who know milk of the human kindness, as Shakespeare has it, that it doesn't surprise me in this hard world of ours. But now and again, and I got to know him, we were working together on a project, and therefore I got to know his movements and the way he dressed, and he used to wear a perfume, some eau de cologne, perfectly legitimate, and I knew the way he talked and the sound of his voice and his quirks of raising his head like that when he was thinking, looking up to the left. And I got to know him. And once or twice he came in to see me. Once or twice I saw him alone in a brown study. He didn't know I was there. And I said to myself, I don't know that man. That's an alien. That's alien. And finally it hit my belly that he was totally alien inside. And I had a conversation with him about it. And since I was what I was, he opened up somewhat, but in a very veiled way, but he told me. But there's this alien touch. You suddenly find out, I don't know this man. I thought I did. He's utterly alien. And it's this look. It's a frightening look. And most people, when they meet it, just say, oh, he's crazy, or he's a pain in the neck, or something. They don't bother about it. But they're perfectly possessed. You never touch them. You walk away from it. Never try and have anything to do with them, because they're completely gone. They've given in completely, and they're Faust. They've signed the document for their soul to go, and it's a terrible thing. The extent of it is very big today. As I say, we have about over 8,000. It's 8,042 were the last count I saw. And these are worshipping covens composed of not ignorant men and women, not people who are stupid, on the road, homeless, jobless, you know. No, these are doctors, lawyers, architects, brokers, painters, dancers. Nuns, priests, cardinals, bishops.
Some of these people are in powerful positions then?
My dear man, the last coven we had to deal with indirectly through this woman. I mean, it was a galaxy of names. If you want anything done in medicine or in finance in New York or Albany, just be in the coven. Absolutely top-flight people and perfectly well-behaved in normal life. Family member, family men, men and women, society members. You know, they were known to people, and some of them are very, very well-known names in their world, the part of the world in New York, and probably in Washington, too. It's only the perfectly possessed that frighten myself. I met some of them in Washington and some of them elsewhere in this country, and they all frighten me because they're completely dedicated. It's like meeting a complete and utter Russian spy, or a spy for the Soviet Union in those bad days. In America, once you meet them, you know, they're going to betray everything without mercy. Similarly with them, too. It is an unpleasant thing. And my advice to anybody about it is this. Know about exorcism. Know about possession. Know how to avoid the devil's inroads. But do not touch it otherwise. It is mucky, dirty, insalubrious, unhealthy, inhuman, and not to be thought about. It's like the old priest who instructed me originally in Cairo said to me, Malachi, he said, this whole thing is like a bowel movement. We have to deal with it, but he said it's not to be thought about. He was an Irishman. That was his way of putting it. It's his way of saying that don't touch it, keep away from it, unless you have to. Now, you must inform yourself, and therefore some book like mine is useful to you, very useful because it's above board. Some of the language is hard to carry, and I don't advise certain people who ask me for the book. I say, no. When I know them, I say, no, don't read the book yet. Wait for a couple of years, especially if they're young, and especially if they're very sort of tender, and they can't face brutal facts very easily. Some people can't. So I don't advise them to read the book, but I say to anybody, you should know about it and know the details, but you needn't go into any great... And above all, watch out, the trap's laid for you. Don't use the Ouija board. Don't attend spiritual seances. Don't use cards to tell fortune. Don't do transcendental meditation. don't do Ron Hubbard's course. You will end up, one way or the other, with harassment at least, if not possession. And you won't know it, because you've been trained by these systems to do it. But so don't, keep away from it.
Why are only certain priests delegated to be exorcists? Why can't just any priest do an exorcism?
Strictly speaking, any priest could, if he's delegated. But experience has shown the following, Bernard. The typical exorcist is not a very poetic-minded character. He's not flowery. He's not a first-class humanist. He's usually a very stolid character with what we call good moral judgment. You know the type? Sometimes they're boring, by the way. Very boring, because they're straight and clear-minded, and for them, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, and they don't indulge in wild superstitions or wild romanticism or, as I say, in poetry, number one. Number two, they have to be of proven moral character. And that's one of the reasons why young priests can't be, because when you're young, you haven't proved yourself. I think that by the age of 45 or 50, if you have careful superiors, careful bishops, careful parish priests, they know you. They know you're predictable. You're predictable, number two. Number three, they must have good theology, because without good theology, you can be deceived. You can undertake an exorcism of a person, man or a woman, boy or girl, and the answers you get, if you're not able to judge them, they can deceive you. That the exorcism is done, that there's no devil there, there's no possession there, you can be deceived. So that's the first three qualifications. And not everybody fits into that. In fact, if you take a roster of priests nowadays that I meet, the young priests coming out of the seminaries, there's one man. He's going to be ordained next June. With time, he might develop into it. But we don't breed this type of animal any longer. Then, you see, there's also this about that many priests, and I know them, have refused. Why? Bernard, there's an unconscious, an invisible toll on the human spirit once you do exorcisms. What is it like? Well, let me give you the example, say, of a father and a mother. You must know hundreds of fathers and mothers. I certainly do. And when I talk to them, they have loved their children, and reared their children, now they're grandmothers. They're very near becoming grandfathers and grandmothers. You find them continually saying, oh, no, I gave that son. I gave him all I got. I gave him everything. And they'll tell you what they did in order to bring him to where he succeeded, or his daughter or her daughter, their mother and father talking about them. They're always saying, implying that in order to love them properly as their father or their mother, they had to give of themselves. And they're not talking about money. They also gave money. They're talking about time. They gave time. Or their embrace, their kiss, their encouragement. They mean all those things too. What they really mean is they've given something of themselves. And I remember one father said to me, about a son at West Point at the graduation. And the boy was feckless. He was so happy over his graduation that he couldn't come back and tell his father about certain ceremonies that father wanted to hear about, because the father himself had graduated 50 years before that. And he wanted to hear his son tell about the secret celebrations that the cadets have, that the officers have when they're graduated. And he said to me, sort of almost with tears in his eyes, he said, you know, I'll never know what happened, he said, Malachi. He will never tell me. And he said, I can't take back what I gave him, because I gave him part of me. And it's true. And the mother will know that she has invested so much love in that child that she could never do it again. And it's, if you really love a woman as a man, or if a woman loves a man as her husband, once they give that love, you can't do the same. It's only done once, really once. And then you haven't got to give. You give a part of yourself. There's this peculiar transmission of the soul in its fruitful capacity. Now, an exorcist has to do that. Every time you do an exorcism or assist at an exorcism, you diminish your what will I call it? It's something like that if you worked so hard with your arm that you strained it beyond. It will never get back to its original pristine condition of being a good strong arm or a good strong foot. Some vitality, some spiritual vitality goes away. And exorcists I know, when they chat, they normally sort of speak about it as that it's a part of them God has taken away and have to wait till they die. And the old exorcists I know are men who are very denuded of self and very calm. There's great composure. Peace is always the result of good exorcisms. Peace, great peace, deep peace. When a person is exorcised and they come out of it and they're cured, but there's a look on their face that you'd pay gold to see, because it even communicates itself to you. It's a majestic composure. They've suddenly woken up to the fact that they're children of God, they're clean. And I think it's because normally your angel accompanies you and has that sort of an atmosphere around him and communicates it unconsciously to you. And they have it back. And they no longer have this shadow, as one man described it to me, always on the side of your eyes. You can never see it, except on the side of your eyes, but you know it's there. And it possesses you, it holds you. You do what it says, whether it's masturbation or stealing or killing or lying or what. It's always there. And has the grip. Do this, and you do it automatically. It's slavery. It's slavery. Now, so that's why it's limited. Thirdly, then, there's the fact that that people won't do it. I know people said, no, I won't, Your Grace. You can fire and complain to Rome, defrock me, but I'm going to do an exorcism. I remember one man just wouldn't. And the bishop said, why? He said, because I can't do it, he said. I'll fall. I love lots of things I read in these books. He's a very honest man. He's still a priest and a good priest, but he knew his own weakness. I've known intellectual priests who said, no, I can't do that because I'd be trapped. I'll make a mistake. It's a different type of man. It's a very solid, it's the type you find engineers are. Good, solid engineers, you know, they look at the thing, they measure the planks, they can measure the ground with their eyes, and they deal with hardcore figures, and there's no airy-fairy castles in their mind. They're very concrete minds. So it's that type of mind. Now, doubtless anybody can. I knew one exorcist who was a young man, and he was forced into the position because of his bishop and the subject, the exorcist, as they say, but he was too fine, and he died. Well, it wore it. It broke him. It broke him in two. He just couldn't take the horror, because you must be able to stand a terrible stench. I'm not saying physically, that too, but in the nostrils of your soul, if there's such a thing. That's the way of putting it. The disgust. You're dealing with something which is disgusting to your nature. And people should realize that when something is disgusting like that to your nature, it means Christ within you is disgusted. It's Christ if you have him with you. Just as if you are revolted by cruelty and are sad at human iniquity, that is Christ expressing his sadness and his disgust at it. So if you have that. But for some people, it doesn't give them the strength to control that, and that you have pity on them. And the bishop doesn't force them. If the bishop believes, that's the difficulty. So that's why they limit it. And then the last principle the church has is never let a whole crowd of fellows go around exorcising, because there could be chaos. You know, there was a time in Europe when everybody was considered to be a witch who wasn't a nun or something like that, or didn't give good contributions to the local cathedral. So you had crowds of friars and Dominican friars and Franciscan friars going around exorcising people ad lib. And of course, there's an abuse. And they always condemned a lot of wrong people. Wrongly, they condemned people.
During exorcisms, is holy water used, or is it composed purely of prayers?
We don't understand. God hasn't given us the means of knowing. But God's presence in the world comes in various ways. His chief presence is that he maintains it in existence. His power runs right through everything, through the angels. The steward angels, as they call them, six choirs of the nine angels, of the nine choirs, have nothing to do but to maintain that world in equilibrium. The world of matter, the world of mind, the world of movement, the world of oceans and lands, and the whole thing. That's one presence he has. Another presence that God has in this life amongst men is the sacramental presence. His body and blood and soul and divinity are present in that tabernacle. A third presence is through sacramentals. What are those? Those are things which the church has had from the very beginning. A crucifix, specially blessed and hanging on the wall, a rosary beads, a chaplet, the Simon Stock, the scapular, holy water, holy bread, whatever it is, God gets a special blessing from God and therefore becomes a special part of the incarnation of divinity in this stuff and matter of our world. Holy water is like that. The power of sacramentals is traditionally known to be limited by your faith. It's like the story of the old woman, you know, who had this awful hill to climb up and to go down before she got to the church. She used to want to go to Mass every day. And she finally, the priest said to her, Katie, make a novena. Christ said, faith will move mountains. Make a nine-day novena. And you can shift the mountain with your faith. So she did for 9 days. The story goes, it's an Irish story, which probably never happened, but anyway, or perhaps it did, but in another way. And finally, as she used to look out every morning to the mountain and say, you'll be gone in 9 days, or you'll be gone in 8 days, you'll be gone in 7 days. And the night before she went to bed, she looked out of the mountain and said, you won't be there in the morning. I'll have a flat walk over to Mass. Well, when she got up in the morning, the mountain was still there. So she said, I knew you'd be there all the time. She really didn't believe. So the power of the sacramental of making this novena, a novena is a sacramental of another kind, wasn't allowed work. You must believe, must have faith. And if always knows the saints, whether it's Padre Pio or whoever, John Bosco or St. Ignatius, they always use something. Christ himself, remember, he used to mix mud with his spittle and put it in your ears and, in order to show that sacramentals had power if you have the faith. And he had the power and he had the faith. So holy water is used, and holy water is very powerful. And as you know, there's a French expression, when you want to say somebody's very uncomfortable, you say it's like Lucifer in a holy water font. And it does make, they dislike holy water very much. It's like crucifixes too, but holy water and Lourdes water. That Lourdes water is very, very powerful water, we find. But holy water, any holy water is, there should always be holy water in the house. And we should bless ourselves with it. But in an exorcism, it's used extensively. And it doesn't burn them, it just drives them crazy. In the exorcism, the picture, the priest shook some water on them, and it's sort of as if it was burning nitroglycerin or something. It wasn't that. It's that any approach of divinity is torture. Is torture. So yes, holy water is used, and a crucifix is used, and holy candles are used. Sometimes there's a danger with those because they're blown out, they're kicked, they're thrown, they're spat upon, they're split in three ways. I've seen candles split down like zigzag, like this, and somebody ran a knife through them. Things you can't describe to people. The temperature in the room can change, can go from freezing cold, 5 below, to 100 degrees within the drop of a hat.
So very dramatic things can happen during exorcism.
Very, very. If the demon is very angry and very powerful, if you make mistakes, or if there's a big prize at stake, then you can expect a dirty struggle. Sometimes the demon is extremely stupid. You can trap it maliciously because you're the killer, or it's the killer. There's no here. There's no mercy. There's no humor. There's sardonic. Schadenfreude, as the Germans say, laughing at somebody's hurt, but there's no real humor or wit in it at all. So yes, holy water is used, and a lot of other things are used too, like that.
Now, are exorcisms sometimes performed on places or objects?
Yes, you can exorcise a place or an object. A room is obsessed, a room is possessed. A room can be obsessed too, just as what they call the Poltergeist syndrome, you know? It's really, it's on its way to possession. Why did I say that takes place? We don't know exactly. We have guesses, and the church has always had reasons for thinking, and theologians have, and then saints have given us revelations, but there's nothing dogmatically fixed why places are obsessed, but we know they are possessed and obsessed. Usually there are places where there's been a gross injustice, or there's a murder, or there's a body buried unknown, or there's been a severe desecration of the Holy Holy Communion or the Mass, or there's been a violation of a nun or a priest, or it's a funny thing. You know, there's a it works both ways. You know, Our Lady, when she appeared in Spain, in Garabandal, at one stage she told the children to collect everybody's rosary beads and to she blessed them. And they put them all into a basket, and she brought up to Our Lady, and the Lady blessed them all. Then the child came out and was giving back all the rosary beads back to their owners, and she knew instinctively by divine help who to give the rosary beads to, except that when she was leaving Our Lady, Our Lady said, there's a powder compact in there, don't give it to the person, because it was a pyx, it was stolen and made into, if you know what a pyx is, it's the little box that the priest carries the host in, that belongs to my son. So it was a sacramental that had this mark forever, that had once been used for the Blessed Sacrament. And now had been used, turned into a woman's powder compact with a little powder puff in it. So it does affect them physically. And I bet you, Bernard, if you walked into some of the areas I've had to walk into in this world, especially in Europe, in the Middle East, but also in America, you'd know instinctively no sacramental had ever entered. There'd never been any holiness there. And the moment you sprinkle holy water there, the moment, and pray, there's some immediate lifting of the atmosphere, I don't know what it is, or else you get out fast. The world is either full of God or it's full of the devil. There's no in-between. There's no neutral terrain.